Hey, hi. Welcome to Someone Else's Movie, the original podcast where an actor, writer, director, or nebulous industry figure gives a little love to a movie they didn't make. I'm Norm Wilner, senior film writer for Now Magazine, and this is the other thing I do. My guests this week are Emily Gagné and Danita Steinberg, a filmmaker and comedian, respectively, who hosted the podcast What About Meryl for 2 years and just launched their follow-up show We Really Like Her, in which they discuss the women they love who make movies. The first two episodes premiered last week, and the third episode drops tomorrow, and you can find it wherever you found this show, probably. Emily and Danita picked Scream, the blockbuster horror movie that spawned a franchise, launched several careers, saved Wes Craven, and made slasher movies cool again. It's a near-perfect execution of what Roger Ebert called the dead teenager movie, with a charming, confident cast that includes Neve Campbell, Courtney Cox, David Arquette, Skeet Ulrich, Rose McGowan, Matthew Lillard, and Jamie Kennedy, and it's also an ingenious commentary on that genre, with a screenplay by Kevin Williamson that turns the conventions inside out by letting the characters be aware of the rules of horror movies and making sure the killers know them too. More than 20 years, 3 sequels, and dozens of pale imitations later, Scream still stands on top of the bloody pile, and with good reason. This is someone else's movie.
Oh, well, we went through a lot of deliberation because we're multifaceted ladies, and I feel like we love really, like, feminine movies, and one of our other choices we thought about doing was Legally Blonde, which actually would have been very apropos right at this moment.
Sure.
But we also love horror movies, and I think that that's sort of a part of our life that we, like, also want to share with the world, too. Mm-hmm. Right?
Yeah. And I think it's funny because as similar as, like, our sensibilities are, they also, like, differ a lot. So I think we like a lot of the same movies, but what we love is, like polar, kind of on, like, polar opposite.
Yeah.
Opposites of the spectrum. So that was kind of, like, a challenge for us to, like, figure out, like, a couple movies or, like, just this, or Scream. So that's a movie that we both, like, really love.
Okay, and how did you come to it? Because you're not old enough to have seen it. I mean, I'm old. I've seen them all theatrically, but in 1996, you would not have been able to get
a movie. So. Yeah, I mean, I was, like, 7 when it came out. Well, we're the same age. Yeah. So, yeah, we would have been 7 when it came out. And I don't totally remember exactly when I saw it, but I know I was too young to have been watching it.
Right.
Because I always had kind of, like, because my mom's into horror movies, and I had, like, older cousins always hanging around the house who were into horror movies, so I was exposed to, like, everything way too young. So I was probably when it came out on video, so, like, a year or two later, I probably, like, we rented it from Blockbuster and watched it.
Yeah, I mean, I, of course, didn't see it in the theater either, but, yeah, I think it was a similar situation. I actually tried to remember the first time that I watched it, and I can't fully remember it. I'm sure it was in the basement of my parents' house.
Sure.
But I did see I Know What You Did Last Summer first, which was my first foray into horror movies. It was my first horror movie, and I was so scared by it, which is funny on reflection, but I was so scared by it, I thought the hook guy was going to come get me. But that sort of introduced me to horror, and then I think I found out that Scream was another movie that was similar, in a similar vein, and I mean, I was very excited because, like, Drew Barrymore was in it, and I loved her. My first favorite movie was E.T., so I've known Drew since I was in the womb. So, yeah. So I was very excited to watch it, and it became such a big part of my childhood. Mm-hmm. Like,
me too.
I feel like we watched it at so many, like, sleepovers or, like, you know, with friends. It was just that movie that I think our generation, like, grew up watching and loving, because it was, like, a scary movie, but not really that scary. So your friends that don't like horror movies could still watch it.
Sure, yeah. It's the fun one.
Right? Yes. Like,
it's the one that's a party.
Yes.
And that, which was its appeal in 1996, because there hadn't been a movie like that. I mean, there are a couple of Friday the 13th films that are self-reflexive, and there's a party spirit to some of the 80s movies, like House and Fright Night. I mean, that was my adolescence. I came up through the 80s watching those movies in theaters with people, which was something like you cannot explain to people now.
I can only imagine.
People just, you know, like, I remember an audience for, the third Nightmare on Elm Street movie, Dream Warriors, and it played like a rock concert. People were so stoked for it. And when you step back a bit and say, well, this is a silly exploitation movie about a child murderer who somehow is caught on with teenagers. Okay, cool. Where do we go with this? And then the movie turns out to be good.
Yeah.
And it was rewarding. Or, you know, Hellraiser with an audience in 87. The spirit of the films, I I mean, I obviously, I love genre. I'm a longtime horror nerd, but watching people embrace the older films now, what, like all the Shout Factory, Scream Factory stuff that's coming out, realizing that this is the target market for collectors, I think, in a weird way, that wouldn't be happening without Scream in 96, which was simply, like, it was considered revelatory just because it had characters in it who knew about horror movies, right? I mean, there are other films that joke about them, but this was the first time that you had the screenwriter kind of depend on the audience being that smart, and then the filmmaker executing it properly.
Yeah, and the filmmaker that makes it is like a horror icon, which I think adds to the legitimacy of it, right?
Well, I should point out, he's a horror icon now. He was an incredibly disreputable horror icon before Scream.
But he made A Nightmare on Elm Street.
Sure, but he also made Deadly Blessing and, you know, The Hills Have Eyes 2. He made a lot of really bad movies.
Well, yeah, I mean, he started with, like, exploitation stuff. And then after, he made Music of the Heart, which is
my personal favorite.
Okay, that does bring us back to Meryl.
But you know, I don't know, like, somebody that has experience in the genre, I feel like, made the movie, so I feel like he's, you know, speaking the language. Yeah.
Oh, I think Craven was absolutely the right person for the job.
Yeah.
Right? But Kevin Williamson's script is just so, it's so smart.
Yeah,
it's
and
so...
I just have such an affinity for Kevin Williamson and everything he makes, like even like Teaching Mrs. Tingle and Dawson's Creek and
The Faculty,
and I Know What You Did Last Summer. Like, they're all just so good and cool and weird.
Yeah.
You know, and I think he celebrates pop culture in a way that, like, you don't get, like, reflected at you very often, which I really appreciate. I think, like, watching Scream, it's like, these are people that love movies, and so when I was watching when I was younger, it's like, I could really just, like, identify as someone who also loved movies.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, when I was watching this again, I mean, I've seen this so many times. Like, I don't know.
Yeah, a million.
Like 50 times.
Yeah.
But watching it again, I was, like, looking at it really closely, and I was like, I am Randy. Like, I was like, I hate to think that I am, but I'm Randy.
Sure, yeah.
Like, when he's talking about Jamie Lee Curtis, I was just like, that's me.
Yeah.
But like, I love that you have that character that you can sort of, like, insert yourself
into.
You're just like, oh, you know, this person that knows all the rules of it.
Yeah, like, we were probably, like, the movie nerds, like, of our friend groups.
100%.
Yeah.
Well, and he's just, like, not cool and not having sex or doing anything interesting. And I was that's me. Yeah. I just wanted to talk about horror movies and nobody cared.
Yeah, I just went to, like, Video Flicks every week in high school and rented 7 movies.
Yeah.
And that's what all I did.
Yeah. And, and again, without, you know, that access, without that library, it is just another horror movie that people don't totally get.
But yeah.
I think that's... Like, it came a couple of years after Clerks. It was right around the same time as Tarantino. The genuine, I don't know how to describe it, but the rubber band effect in the 90s where everything commented on everything else and depended on the commentary to really work. I think Scream is sort of the pinnacle of it, or maybe Scream 2, where they expand the conversation to sequels. But it also works as a straight horror film that doesn't cheat and plays fair. And even, I mean, I remember seeing it theatrically the first time and kind of, the staging in that first attack on Sydney where someone, well, I guess we can get into spoilers. It's a 20-year-old. I always hesitate with stuff that I really love because you don't want to spoil it for people.
Yeah,
but I'm
totally
assuming if people are listening to this that they have a passing familiarity
with
at least the first one.
Yeah.
But that moment where Skeet Ulrich races back in, you're just like, he got there really fast.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I actually, I was like, how do people not think it's Billy? Like, it's clearly Billy, but then by the midpoint of the movie, you're like, it's not Billy. Like, you're convinced it's not, which is, like, the power, I guess, of the film and the screenwriting that you kind of get distracted. But it's, like, even Stu, like, at the beginning, Stu is like, oh, like, cut them from stem to sternum or something. And you're like, why is he, like, these guys are idiots.
That's awfully vivid. Why would you, just casually drop that in conversation?
You know?
But it's playing with the tropes, right? Like, it knows we have seen all the other movies, or at least it's depending on us. Having seen, I guess, there were a bunch of whodunit kind of slasher films in the 80s that nobody really remembers. I vague, like The Beast Must Die and stuff like that.
Which, yeah.
Who's the werewolf? Who cares? It's a werewolf. But, you know, just wait. Wait until midnight on the night of a full moon. You'll find out who the werewolf is. But this one actually, and I just saw, there's a movie opening, I'm trying to figure out when we release this. There's a movie opening this Friday in Toronto called Beast, which... Mm-hmm. Has no werewolf in it and is very disappointing as a result. But it's about a young woman attracted to a young man who may or may not be behind this spate of murders in her little village on the Channel Islands. And the mistake it makes is it leans in so heavily to that erotic thriller trope of who the killer might be that every single male character has to be vaguely menacing at least once in the film just to keep it going. And you're supposed to think, is the film trying to say that we all have the capacity for this? Or is it just bad writing that they're trying to cover up the fact that the killer's really obvious?
Yeah.
And Scream, bless its heart, it doesn't make it obvious. It makes you work to follow the plot.
It does. I think I had to watch this movie like 30 times until I like remembered who the killers were. Okay. Like I used to watch it and always forget, which I think is just so exciting and makes it just like forever rewatchable.
Well, there's also that moment when like Billy gets stabbed. Mm-hmm. And like that's mm-hmm. that point where you're like, well, it's not Billy. And it hasn't entered into your head that there's two killers.
Yeah.
Like I think that's the genius point of it, because there's so many other horror movies where it's just the one killer, it's the one villain. But in this, like, that totally messes with your head. I was like, well, if it's not Billy, who the heck is it? What's going on? Yeah, yeah, we haven't seen your dad. Maybe it really is her dad. Sure. You know, but he did seem really sweet when you saw him for, like, 5 seconds. And you're like, it can't. It's also not.
And also, like, they're just other teens.
Yeah.
Which is part of it. Like, they're not, like, some menacing, like, weirdo. You know? I mean, they're weirdos, but they're not, like, lurking around in the shadows. Like, they're kind of, like, among their peers but and killing them off.
Isn't that the scariest part? Yeah, was like for these sure. guys that seem very charming, which is such a serial killer thing,
yeah.
though, right?
Yeah.
Like a Ted Bundy who's like really charming and you don't suspect him, like even if you're best friends with him, you know, like you just think that, oh, he's this nice guy.
Yeah.
So you think these two guys are nice guys and you want to suspect Randy, who's actually the nice guy, the sweet guy.
Mm-hmm.
I would date Randy, I guess, is what I'm trying to say. But yeah. But also, I think what I really, like, we talked a lot about the guys, but, like, I think what I really love about this movie is I love Sydney Prescott. I think she's such a cool final girl.
Yeah, she is a really strong character. And again, that's, like, Williamson just writing strong leads.
Yes.
But Neve Campbell, she was perfect for it.
Yeah.
When that happened, she was the sort of actor that everybody was kind of underestimating and nobody really gave her much credit for anything. And, you know, stuff like Wild Things came later, but she really does just slot right into a 1970s dependent. Like, she's Laurie Strode in Halloween. She is the Jamie Lee Curtis of the movie in that she is smart, kind of aware, self-aware, as well as aware of what's going on. She's capable of navigating all this stuff, and she's strong enough to survive it, but also there's a chance she could die. I mean, there's a legitimately, especially with the way Scream opens by introducing and murdering poor Drew Barrymore, which is like a perfect short film in itself.
It is. It's probably, I would say, my favorite opening scene of any movie ever. I love it so much. Every time I watch it, it just floors me. It is so scary and unrelenting and creepy, and it always just like gets under my skin. And I remember like that is what like horrified me as a kid. And especially like the scene at like when her mother finds her like hanging from a tree and she's like inside out.
But even right before that, like the part that kills me is when she's like trying to get mom.
Yeah,
she can't.
It's terrifying. Like just the thought that like you were almost saved.
Oh, that's brutal.
You know?
Well, like, it makes it sadistic rather than just violent, right? Like it's sadistic towards the audience. It's
yeah, it is. Cruel. It is. Yeah.
Yeah.
I felt like maybe this is kind of like me just like maturing or like getting older, but like the thing with, I never used to think about this with horror movies, but lately I've been thinking about like just like the trauma that people in horror movies go through and like how devastating it is. And like I felt so sad for her parents last night while I was watching this.
Yeah.
And I mean I haven't watched it in a few years, maybe I felt it then, but I just felt it like so acutely last night. And that struck me.
We don't see them again in the film, do we?
They
don't show up like Mrs. Kintner and Jaws and just have a moment.
No.
That'd be cool if they did. But no, it's just that one-off moment, which, makes it really scary because it's just, first of all, you're like, Drew Barrymore's not going to die. And then she dies. And she's so good in that scene. Like, I feel like you're so scared for her.
Yeah.
But she's also so charming at the beginning.
Yeah, no, the slide from kind of flirtatious confusion to terror is handled really, really well. And almost, the last time I looked at it,
was shocking that no one has given her other stronger stuff. I know she's tried for roles and not got them, and she's settled into this romantic comedy thing for a while, and now on Santa Clarita Diet, she's just delightful. And
yeah.
That's an amazing role for her. But there's, like, chops. She's got incredible dramatic chops in that scene.
The part that kills me, and I actually, again, I never noticed this, which is shocking to me, considering how much I've watched it, but, like, there's the part when Ghostface, like, asks her, like, the question about Friday the 13th, like, who's the killer on Friday the 13th, then she answers Jason, and it's actually Mrs. Voorhees, and then she goes, "You tricked me." And it's, like, this very small line that she has, and it, like, it just broke my heart.
Yeah, the betrayal of it.
Because she was like, "Oh, I'm screwed now. Yeah. Like, this is it."
And it's, like, your favorite movie's turning against you.
Yeah.
And that's what I love about this scene is, like, literally, like, I can think of nothing better than, like, sitting at home on a Friday night, eating popcorn and watching a movie. Yeah. And Wes Craven, like, just presents that in such a, like, enticing way, because that's probably what he loves doing, too. So he gets it.
Love doing.
Yeah. Mm. Well, oh, God.
Sorry.
And
he went out doing what he loved.
Yeah.
He did.
I think just the late career renaissance of Wes Craven, we were just talking about it. Like, that's... He was a really sweet guy who never fought with anyone on his sets and was... He made a lot of garbage and then suddenly got the chance to not make garbage. That was nice.
Yeah. He's one of my absolute favorites.
We'll get back. I'm derailing all the conversation.
No, it's okay. It's fine.
He weaponized the experience of seeing a movie at home, which is the something that in 1996 that people were really embracing. Like, video was king. Theaters were dying then, you know, for that reason. And Scream reminded everybody of the pleasure of being scared in the dark with a bunch of other people.
There's nothing better to me, and I think that's because Scream isn't my favorite movie of all time, but like, for me, there's nothing better than, like, a good horror movie that, like, trumps everything for me. But there are just so few of them,
the really good ones, the repeatable ones.
So I think that's just what I love Scream for, is that it's, like, a good horror movie that, like, for anyone who kind of, like, is a naysayer against horror movies, you can be like, well, here's Scream. Here's something that, like, does something really interesting and smart and cool, and it's scary and funny, and, like, it's just, we're watching it last night, I was like, oh yeah, this is why I love movies, you know?
Yeah, it's just, I can't imagine not liking it. Like, how would you watch Scream and be like, oh, this sucks? It's such a fun movie. And it is really a movie. Like it's a perfect example of a movie. Just something, that you want to have popcorn and watch with a group of friends. And I've watched it so many times with groups of friends. I actually remember, like, watching it with girls at a sleepover. And I was, like, the weird girl that liked horror movies. Half the time, the girls didn't want to watch them, which sucked. I didn't know you, unfortunately. Yeah. But I remember them, like, watching the opening scene and being like, I can't watch anymore. It's too scary.
Well, the opening scene is too scary.
Yeah.
But then it, you know, mellows out.
It bummed me out because I was, like, trying to convince them. I was like, guys, that's the scariest it's going to get. You're going to be fine. You're going to have a good time. And they're like, no.
It's hard, yeah. I remember watching it with an audience that had no idea. Like, they clearly had no idea. It was a 10 a.m. screening, a press screening at the Uptown One. And they made an event of it. They invited people. It was a big packed house for both the first and second Scream films. Miramax and Alliance back in the day did that sort of thing. Like, there was a 10 a.m. preview of Trainspotting that was packed with people.
Wow.
It was the equivalent now, I guess, would be an influencer screening where, you know, these people seem cool. Let's invite them to a free movie and hope they talk about it. There was no social media then. You just got this fax saying, come here at this time. In the olden days.
There's
a whole different world. But yeah, at 10 a.m., on a Thursday morning, we went down and saw Scream, and it was, like, everybody going in was just like, oh, it's Craven. Okay. He hasn't done anything in a while. Although I really like New Nightmare, the last of the Freddy movies he made, which sort of prefigures Scream a lot. In the interactivity of it.
Yeah.
And kind of works now as the proof of concept. I think if you go back and watch it, it's kind of weird that there are two other Scream movies where they talk about people making a movie out of Scream. And that's the plot of New Nightmare. And it's not as funny, but it's legitimately terrifying.
Yeah.
And the Scream films are lighter just by nature.
Yeah.
But then, you know, you get to sit with 500 people in this theater in the dark and on a morning, like a 10 a.m. bleary morning, and just it ride. It's a ride. Like, you just, mm-hmm. you strap in and it's just a delightful ride. And to get back to where I originally derailed this, a lot of that is Neve Campbell steering, like sort of telling us, projecting the tone, getting it right, going from traumatized childhood pain to dynamic hero mm-hmm. and never really winking. Like, the only time I think Sydney has ever winked in the entire four films is at the end of the second one, where she says, "Not in my movie."
And yeah.
That's cool. That's like the thing the hero says at the end of the movie. It's perfectly reasonable. But before Scream became Scream in the first movie, Campbell's playing the reality of it in just enough of a fun way that we're not terrified for her throughout. We're nervous, we're worried, but she's established as the hero so quickly that she will be the final girl. Even before we have that phrase, we know she's going to survive the first few action sequences.
Yeah, well, and she fights back. Like, mm-hmm. when there's the time when she's, like, home alone, and then Ghostface shows up, and it's clearly Billy, because then he shows up right after that. But, yeah, she, like, fights him. Like, she's on the floor fighting with Ghostface. And I just was like, that is so great to me. Because, like, I love Laurie Strode. Halloween is my actual favorite movie, and I could talk about it forever, and I'm freaking out about the new movie. But anyways, that's a whole other conversation. But Laurie Strode, I love her, but, like, she fights back, but I feel like she's a little unsure, and she's still very afraid. But there's something with Sydney where, like, I don't feel like she's ever fully afraid. Mm-hmm. Like, I mean, she is a little afraid because, quite frankly, she's going through some horrible things, but she, like, is always ready to fight back.
She's in control.
Yeah, she's very mm-hmm. in control, and I think, like, that's why she succeeds. But also, just as a side point, like, there are two final girls in this movie. Gail Weathers is technically a final girl, too. That's true, yeah. And it's, I don't know if you were at, there was an event at the Royal Cinema here, the Black Museum. They do those, like, lecture series.
Yeah, no,
I
wasn't there.
They did a lecture about the best final girl. And there was these two girls that
a debate.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
They usually do lectures, but this was a debate. Yeah. And it was, like, people brought different final girls that they thought were, like, the best final girl. And, like, somebody brought Nancy from Nightmare on Elm Street, who ended up winning. What's the name of the girl from The Witch?
I don't know.
Thomason,
yeah.
And then Sally from Texas Chainsaw. And then these two girls brought Gail Weathers.
They argued for Gail.
And it
was really compelling, actually.
It's hard to argue against her.
Well, listen, Gail's in all of the other movies along with Sydney. And Gail, like, really comes through in the movie. Like, you kind of hate Gail, but I love that her and Sydney, over the course of the franchise, sort of become friends.
Yeah.
And, like, partners in fighting against these horrible people that keep coming after them.
Which makes a lot of sense emotionally, even if it doesn't necessarily plot-wise, that they would bond over that, because no one else, you know, they're used to not being believed, they're used to being attacked and assaulted. And also, after a while, it's like survivors of some sort of accident where you're it's crash or fearless. You know, the only other person who understands you is the person who was there too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely.
And also is Courtney Cox, who is just remarkably great.
She's so good. And she's just like a cool working woman, you know?
Yeah.
And she just, like, gets the story no matter what. And, like, people kind of, like, find that as, like, a bad quality, but it's not. It's cool, you know?
I love her.
Yeah, I love her, too.
I like tabloid journalism, too, so I feel like I'm on her side.
Yeah, I'm on her side, too.
And we love true crime, so I feel like, listen, if I could read the Woodsboro Murders book, I would. I'd buy it tomorrow. I'd probably buy three copies. I'm surprised
no one has published one at this point.
I know!
Fan fiction version.
There's probably someone on Etsy that's made, like, a cover that you can have, which I should look into or make now that I'm thinking about it.
Letters from Cotton Weary.
But, like, also, speaking of Cotton Weary, like, they set up all these other things in here that, like, will lead to all these sequels. Like, the Cotton Weary thing is, like, a brief mention.
Mm-hmm.
And, like, also the fact that Sydney's mom, like, died. I mean, that really comes to play in Scream 3, but Sydney's going through so much.
Yeah.
Like, she's very complicated. Not just Ghostface, but, like, she's had this previous trauma. Yeah. She starts off almost as, like, a final girl, so to speak. She's already been through it.
Yeah.
And now she has to face it again, and maybe that's what makes her stronger.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. In that she's already suffered a little bit, and she's like, I'm not going to let anything else get to me.
Yeah, I do like that her default response is anger rather than fear. Like, she punches.
Mm-hmm.
She lashes out at people who attack her. Even, you know, Gail Weathers. their relationship is absolutely antagonistic for the first two movies, I think, maybe even into three. But she's got no time for anything else. She's short-tempered, justifiably. She's not written as an angry person, but Campbell somehow gives you that core, that backbone that Sydney needs to survive, even before any of that happens. And the thing that I just love the most about it is that she's smart. She thinks her way through this stuff. You mentioned Laurie Strode being kind of reactive, which is fair. But the other thing about that is that Halloween, the problem with Halloween ultimately is that not the film. I love the film. But the problem with the Halloween concept is that Michael Myers is indestructible. You can't relate to him. He's a Terminator. You can't reason with him. You can't bargain with him, et cetera, et cetera. He wants to kill you. And eventually he kills you. And whoever's under the mask in Scream, you can break their ribs, you can knock them down, you can knock them out, you can hit them with a car, they're mortal. And that makes it, you know, for the first time in a lot of this genre stuff, or certainly for the first time in a lot of people seeing Scream who were raised on Friday the 13th and Halloween, there's an equal footing. Like, it's a fair fight.
Right. I never thought about it like that, but that's totally true.
Well, it makes it easier to root for Sydney, I think, just because she could actually land a punch.
Yeah, well, she could take this person down. And Ghostface is smaller. Like, it's always doesn't seem to be, like, a huge person under the suit.
Well, because it's, like, a real person.
Yes, so. Yes, it's not just, like, a monster size. Like, Jason seems to get bigger every single time I see him.
Less skin, more size.
It's weird. It's weird. He's, like, waterlogged permanently. But, yeah, that's really interesting. I've never thought about it that way. And, I mean, like, I'm not trying to rag on Laurie Strode, who's my absolute favorite final girl, but I think, like, maybe she reacts more like a person would react, in that you would be scared, but I think, like, what I like about Sydney is she's, like, someone to aspire to, because, like, she just makes me go, like, just, you can take on anything if you really put your mind to it and really fight back, and I love that. I think that Nancy from A Nightmare on Elm Street is, like, similar kind of character, which is, like, why I've always loved Wes Craven, because I think that, like, those two final girls, like, were such a big part of my childhood, and that, like, me loving horror films is I was like, look at these girls fighting back. Look at what they're doing. Nancy's so smart. She sets traps for Freddy.
Yeah. She hides a coffee maker under the bed, which is incredibly dangerous, but good for her.
Totally. But I feel like Sydney would do the same thing. And actually, she kind of does.
She does, yeah.
Like, later on in the series, she, like, basically, like, lives in seclusion and, like, sets, you know, alarms and has things ready to go because she knows what's happened. And I love seeing that. I love seeing that. I feel like it's empowering. Do you feel the same?
Yeah, I don't look at it like that, but I could see it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
I don't know. I love it. It just makes me want to kick some ass. I don't know. I grew up on Buffy, too, right?
Yeah, so. I was going to bring up Whedon, because I think without Williamson, the template for Buffy would be very different. I mean, Joss Whedon had already written Buffy the Vampire Slayer and made the movie in 92, but nobody got it. Mm-hmm. And Scream and Dawson's Creek came along and sort of paved the way again and said, no, self-aware characters in genre situations are totally doable. You just have to trust the writing. And that's how the show is born and saves the day, really.
Yeah, and I mean, Buffy and this came out around the same time. So, I mean, that's why I am the way that I am. I feel like it's, like, so formative.
Well, what's so interesting for me is that I love Williamson, but, like, I am so not into Buffy. I'm so not into Cabin in the Woods. Like, there's something about, like, Joss Whedon's sensibility that just doesn't connect with me for some reason. And I don't have, like, a firm understanding of, like, Whedon's work enough to really, like, understand why. But, like, I tried watching Buffy, like, because I know Emily, like, loves it so much. And I have a few friends who love it. So I've tried getting into it. And I, like, for the life of me, just can't. And I don't know why, but I love Williamson's work.
Yeah.
You know what I find really interesting, though, is, like, we, like, hoist up, like, a Williamson or a Whedon, but, like, we don't want to support Diablo Cody when she makes Jennifer's Body, which I think is, like, a very self-referential movie and, like, really shit upon because she wrote it. Like, she can't be self-referential and, like, fun and whatever. Like, these guys can, and, like, that's their brand, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I don't know what happened with Jennifer's Body. I mean, I saw it at the time and thought it was fine.
Yeah,
but I don't know. I don't know that I blame Cody for that. I think my problems with it are really more about the execution and how it just sort of stumbles in the last third. But yeah, you're right. It wasn't embraced on the level that it could have been. And I mean, people still hated Megan Fox then too.
Yeah,
she had everything is sort of stacked against it.
Totally, but I mean, and I'm not saying it's as good as Scream or anything. I mean, Scream is a perfect movie, and Jennifer's Body has flaws, but
it could certainly be rediscovered. I mean, there's no reason people wouldn't understand it now.
Yeah,
to get what I mean, I guess maybe you just need to lay out the tone and explain what it's going for, sort of let people in personally as opposed to within the film, just sort of say no, like, give it 20 minutes and see if it works.
Yeah,
but it's. I don't know. I remember feeling like you could just tell it wasn't going to, the people weren't going to connect to it. There was something about it. Maybe it was, I'll get that just in case. Nope, Kate's home.
Was Ghostface calling?
Can you imagine? Don't even say that. That scares me.
You want the app.
Right? Like during the day.
Yeah.
A daylight call.
They never did do that, did they? No.
Is there a cell phone call or something? Menacing?
Later on. Yeah, there is in like the fourth one.
Yeah.
I feel like. Because they're all younger, right?
Yeah. Well, that's the other thing too. I mean, to just to wheel it back into Scream and, mm-hmm. and the, I think like, it had to be. Now the 90s horror wave is so defined as the 90s horror wave. We all know what it is. We all know what to look at. I mean, even just the cover design for the Scream DVD or the Blu-ray that we're looking at here is the classic Miramax putting a bunch of young actors in black shirts.
So moody.
They did that for 30 or 40 films. Even stuff where it shouldn't have been, like Phantoms.
Yes.
The totally underrated Phantoms. I have such a soft spot for that weird, weird movie. But as a... like. All of that comes from Scream more than any other work. Like, I Know What You Did Last Summer, I like it a lot, but it is very much a film that is anchored to John Carpenter and specific stylistic things, where the script almost seems to fight with it sometimes because the script is too self-aware for the movie. The movie is very serious and deals with its horror aspects in a really literal sort of almost grinding way where, you know, oh, he can't possibly be there. Yes, he is. But no, he can't. Yes, he is. No, like, in the Scream movies, we'd already be past this.
Yeah.
But the Scream movie, the original Scream, and then the sequel, which is just, I mean, I love it. I think it's really, really smart about what it does.
I love it too. We saw it.
We came to your, when you programmed
the
it.
Now screening.
Yeah.
Yes.
How did that play? I couldn't stay for it.
Did I think it played well. Yeah,
played
I think so.
Very well.
Yeah.
Personally, I love Scream 2. Like, I think it's like number one, number two for me in the ranking. I just think it's so smart.
Yeah.
And I actually have a hard time watching the first one without thinking about the second one. Like, you know, the scene in the hallway with like Billy and Sidney. Like, I always think about the Tori Spelling, like, and oh my God, what's his name? Luke Wilson, like, take in stab in that stab, they show in the second one. Like, I just can't not think of it. And I feel so bad because, like, Neve Campbell's so good in that scene. And I was like, all I'm thinking of is Tori Spelling, which is so funny. But yeah, it's such a good movie, yeah. I think. Though, I mean, it has a brilliant opening scene, too.
Yep. Yeah. Well, I was going to say that the other thing about the Scream series, all four films, is that it is beholden to that format, that like the Bond films that had been going on for 25 years beforehand, you have to open 35 years, Jesus, you have to open with an unrelated prequel sequence, like a prologue that has really very little to do, although in the case of Scream it is directly connected to everything that follows, and then two had to find a meta narrative, and then three had to find a meta narrative, and then four, I don't even remember what they did. I think it was something to do with
the opening.
Yeah,
it was like opening within an opening within an opening.
It was
like
they're recursive.
Girls were watching one of the Stab sequels, and it was a bit much. I mean, it was kind of cool the first time, but then you watch it again, and you're like, oh, okay.
Yeah, I mean, and I'm sure at the time it was the only way to do it, right? You just write yourself into this idea of the best opening, which is then immediately the silliest opening because the simplicity of the first one and the second one, where we immediately open with a narrative. An in-universe argument about why the movie we are watching is unnecessary,
mm-hmm.
and then it just ups the stakes and goes on, and it has Timothy Olyphant, so it's automatically great.
He's really good at it.
He is.
And Laurie Metcalf.
Yep.
That my favorite killer duo, I think.
Yeah, they were great.
Oh, they were excellent. But you know what? Danita and I kind of talk about, like, what scares us and stuff, and,
mm-hmm.
I mean, I think we have different opinions on, like, I think I'm not as scared of supernatural stuff.
Right.
But we often talk about, like, how scary just, like, someone coming to get you is and, like, somebody, like, stabbing you. And I think, like, as silly as, like, the Ghostface costume is in the Scream series, like, the fact that you're just getting stabbed, like, really is what irks me. Because that just feels very real. Like, it brings you back into reality. Like, in the second one, she just gets, like, stabbed in front of everybody. And, like, it's horrifying when you watch her die up on the stage like that. When it's horrifying when Drew Barrymore gets just stabbed. Yeah. She just stabbed and she dies. And I was like, that could be you, you know?
Yeah.
Like, well, not you specifically. But, you know?
No, I know.
It's like, a touch of realism in a movie that's a little bit, like, not super real because it's so self-referential, but, like, it always brings you back.
Yeah, the stakes are always real.
Yes.
I mean, people could die, people could be hurt. I think that, I mean, again, I'm flashing back to the first screening, and there's that moment where whoever's in the suit stumbles over, I think it's the kitchen island or something, and just misses and falls, and people laughed and immediately stopped laughing.
Yeah.
Because it's totally human and unexpected. The one thing you've never seen in a horror movie is the killer not being fluid, graceful, hulking, and terrifying. And just watching somebody mess up and fall over.
Mm-hmm.
It's a jolt. And then they immediately snap back to being, because he got up again. And that's that constant balance of, this is only a movie, I'm sitting in a theater watching something that is very much aware of its moviness, versus the people I like are still getting stabbed and crying and dying. Like, the emotional realism of these movies is, or at least the first two, is really, I mean, it's a hard tightrope to walk, and it pulls it off. Both of them actually make it work really well. I can't believe I fell for it, but the Jerry O'Connell stuff in two is really adorable and sweet. And again, that game where he's presented as a possible suspect, but if you go back the second time, you're just watching some really nice person be completely misunderstood and then die.
Yeah.
And it's tragic.
Like, it's really sad.
It actually lands, yeah.
I know. What's your favorite of the sequels?
I don't have a true love for the sequels, really. I probably saw them as they came out. Mm. And then,
you're just an originalist?
I'm an originalist, for sure. And then I think, like, since Emily and I have become friends, she's so into sequels. So I've kind of just, like, through osmosis, like, have gotten into Nightmare on Elm Street sequels and the Scream sequels. And I like them, but I'm over it, you know? Like,
I think it's just that, like, Danita doesn't, like, get obsessed with anything.
No,
like,
I don't.
She doesn't get too into anything.
No.
She likes stuff, but she doesn't get too into it.
Yeah.
Well, this explains why you're immune to Whedon. Because, like, that's
I think that might be it. I think you guys cracked the code. Yeah, that might be it. I'm kind of, like, turned off by obsession a little bit.
Yeah,
like,
she
I think, like, it makes me uncomfortable, you know, in a way.
Whereas, like, I just, like, get very into things. Not in a crazy way.
No,
but,
you're,
like,
not. You're not,
but I,
obsessive.
But I really, like, I like to, like, extend the life of something. Like, if I'm very into it, like, I want more of it. So, like, even if the sequels aren't great, I'm just like, I'm excited to have more of this.
Yeah.
And it's, like, the same way I feel about this new Halloween movie, where I'm like, I mean, I don't know if it's going to be perfect, but, like, I just want Laurie Strode. Like, I need more Laurie Strode in my life. And she looks incredible. And, you know, so I'm just so psyched about it. And I think the Scream, like, quadrilogy
now, I guess.
Like, I like them all in their own way. Like,
yeah, they are fun.
3 and 4, I would say, sillier than the first two, but I still enjoy them. The third one's, like, very meta in a way that I find, like, a little bit much at times. But the fourth one, I actually, like, I saw that in theaters, and that was, not the first Scream I saw in theaters. The first one I saw in theaters was 3, because I made my dad take me, and I found out later he doesn't like horror movies. He was like, I just went because he really wanted to go.
Oh, that's really sweet. So
cute.
And
I know.
What was his experience of that? I mean, seeing a sequel in a genre he doesn't particularly like.
I mean, he seemed to like it enough. I think that just my mom absolutely cannot stand horror movies. Like, she's too scared of them, so I think she would never take me. Otherwise, she would have taken me, because my mom is the best, and she goes to see most things with me.
Mm-hmm.
But my dad, I think... Also, my dad, like... This is just getting too far into my personal life, but he wasn't home a lot when I was really young because he was working all the time. So I think, like, he took opportunities to hang out with me when he could get them.
That's
so
nice.
He took me to see that in theaters, and I was so excited. It was like when I saw I Still Know What You Did Last Summer in theaters. I think he also took me to see that. And I was like so excited because I hadn't been able to see the originals in theaters. Mm-hmm. I was still too young to be seeing these things.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
I went anyways.
I think we talked about this the other night. Like one of my like first horror movie experiences in the theater was probably Final Destination.
Okay.
Which is like really like a direct like cousin of Scream.
Yeah.
I think, like, what I miss about horror movies today is, like, they're not fun anymore. Or the fun ones are just so bad that they're not fun. Yeah. They're like
well, it's camp happy, instead of...
Happy Death Day was, like, the worst thing that I've ever seen. And oh, I know people really liked it. No, I hated it. I really hated it.
Was it the frustration?
I don't know. I just thought it was so stupid. And I hated the girl on girl fighting and like there was just some I don't know, I just didn't like it. But like Emily just saw Hereditary last night and I saw it like a few weeks ago and it's so buzzed about, but it's good, it's fine, but it's not like horror's just kind of turned into like this like prestigious thing now because they want to like elevate the genre.
The elevated horror trend.
But it's like it's horror doesn't thing. Need to be elevated. Horror when it's good is the greatest. So I think watching Scream last night, I was like, oh, this is fun. Like this is what I'm missing. And I don't know, maybe we're like too we're not like earnest enough as a society anymore to like enjoy a movie like Scream. You know, but they just don't like at 28 I don't want to be like they don't make movies like that anymore.
You're not wrong though. I mean, but, it is true. If somebody I mean maybe it's just that Scream 4 underperformed and they decided that was it. Some cultural shift happened and we were all going to start exploring. I mean, I think something like It Follows comes close.
Mm-hmm.
Where the characters may not reference other horror movies, but the movie is aware of things in a way that makes it fun. And also legitimately scared.
But that movie is also, like, it's still elevated horror.
It looks
really good, and I don't love It Follows, but I won't get into that. That's a whole other conversation. Okay. But I think it's definitely referencing things in a less direct way, for sure. But there are some movies that I think that get put under the rug that kind of have a similar spirit. The movie I'm thinking of in particular is Tragedy Girls, which I, like,
so good.
And I loved that movie. Yeah,
that was the best.
It didn't get a big release.
No, it barely played at all. It was at Toronto After Dark last year, and then just VOD, I think.
Yeah, that's where we saw it. Mm-hmm. And I just, like, that's the kind of movie that I'm looking for, where it's, like, it's fun, it's a nice ride. And that movie actually surprised me just in the places that it went. Like, it had a pretty dark ending. and, like, I was just like, oh, okay. But it also was, like, really gory, and, like, I don't know, it just... That was a really fun time at a horror movie.
Yeah.
And I haven't had that kind of experience in a long time. So I'm kind of looking forward to see whatever that director does next. But also, I would just like to see, more fun horror movies.
Don't
take it so seriously. Or, like, if you're going to take it seriously, take it full serious and make something like The Others. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
I don't know why.
But
I love The Others.
Yeah, I love The Others, too.
Yeah. But, like, go full, go story. Or go fun.
Yeah.
You know, like...
There's just all of these, like, very, like, complicated, like, it's a horror movie, but it's about, like, underlying grief. And, like, I get that, like, genre is, almost always allegorical. Like, sure, that's the point of genre. But I think they're, like, I mean, Scream is about stuff, you know? So I think there's, like, a balance. And there's just, like, these, like, heavy, heavy horror movies, which I guess is, like, it's kind of reflective because we're living in heavy times.
But that's when you need the fun stuff.
But that's,
when you need the anti-venom.
Yeah.
You need something that's more engaged with entertainment as well as.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I like Hereditary. It's one of the most conflicted movie reviews I've ever written because I like it, I admire it, I appreciate it, but I also think that once it clarifies itself and tells you what it is, it gets less interesting.
That's pretty much what we said last night. Familial tension and
mental illness and all the stuff that it's playing with. That's the most interesting thing about horror to me is when you watch a movie where, where the character's psychological issues are pre-existing and magnified by whatever's going on, and where maybe it doesn't have to have what it has. And I'm still, again, not going to spoil Hereditary because it just opened and this is dropping the week after.
Yeah.
But honestly, the second half of that movie goes to places where I get it, I understand it, I appreciate it, but it was less interesting watching it go through those final paces.
Yeah, and why does it have to be this big, like, you know, ending. I think maybe we're caught up on, like, this big ending. And what I like about Scream is that, like, it just ends. Like, they defeat them, and then that's the ending. I love the ending is Gale Weathers, like, reporting from the scene.
Yeah.
And then you get this big shot of just, like, the horizon. Like, it's just perfect. Like, it doesn't, I guess, like...
Yeah, it's the end of Lethal Weapon, weirdly enough. That's what they're quoting deliberately as
the
pullout. I think so. That and a bunch of... And Die Hard. It's all the action. It's how an action movie ended in the 80s. So in the 90s, that's how horror movies ended.
I can see that now that you say that. That's kind of cool.
Yeah, pull back to Carnage.
Yeah, but I love that it's Gale and that she's like an act... It's not just like a random reporter. It's Gale who's part of the story. So, like, it's weird to call Scream simple because, like, there's a lot going on. But I think, like, the simplicity of Scream is... At the core of it, it's just a simple story with, like, added elements. And I think the simplicity is missing from horror. Like, it's, like, either trying to do too much or too little.
Yeah.
And, there's a happy medium. And I think something like Hereditary, to me, is just trying to do too much. When, if it had just dialed back just a little bit, I probably would have loved it.
Mm. Yeah.
You know? And I think you feel the same.
I feel exactly the same.
Yeah. So.
I think there's a point now in elevated horror, and I don't even accept that that's a thing.
We don't.
It's a new fashion for horror, but it's serious horror. That's all it is. It's, you know, it's Robert Wise's The Haunting versus The Legend of Hell House, where one is taking it seriously, not showing the ghost ever, and just making it all work with suggestion and you know, bulging doors and things, versus Hell House, where people are running around screaming, going insane, there's monsters and stuff. They're both satisfying. They both work. It doesn't mean they have to fight with each other for dominance. They just happen to be different spins on the same thing. Where we are now with... I mean, It Comes at Night is one I keep coming back to, which is a film that I still don't fully... like it.
Mm-hmm.
I like the actors. I think the premise is interesting. And then I think that just the fact that so much of it depends on room tone and nightmares and jump scares that aren't real. The thing about the Scream movies is that they are always set in a shared acknowledged reality, the same way Halloween was. The sequels maybe not so much, but you know, the lines are very clear. The stakes are very simple. Someone is trying to kill these people, and why? And that's all you need. And from there, you just build out interesting stuff. You have conversations, you have characters, you have dialogue, you have all the things that, you know, movies are made of. And with Scream and Scream 2, especially, there is an element of participation. The audience is invited in to be part of it.
And that's just what's fun about it, too, is, like, there's nothing better than, like, being in on a joke, you know? And that's, like, what Scream, like, bases itself on.
Yeah. You know? Even if you're not a horror fan, I feel like you can get the references, like...
Yeah.
It doesn't
Well, I don't know. It's in passing. There, you know, there's other things to, like, derive pleasure from out of this movie.
Yeah.
But it's, like, an added pleasure if you get it.
But I think they're Easter eggs for, like, I hate saying real fans, but people that really do love the genre.
For sure. Like, there's a couple levels of references.
Well, there's, like... For example, in the first scene, like, the mom or dad is like, go over to the Mackenzies, which is a reference to Halloween when Laurie's like, go over to the Mackenzies to the kids.
Yeah.
And, like, so that's a reference. But then there's stuff like when she says, like, out of some Wes Carpenter flick or whatever. Like, that I think is, like, general enough that somebody could get it. And also we have Randy, who is, like, this, like, conduit for us for understanding, the genre and this in the place of the genre. Like, he's talking about movies, but he's saying the names. Prom Night, he's like...
Yeah.
He's kind of giving you a quick, like, history lesson on horror movies in the movie so that you can catch up.
Yeah.
You know?
That's true. I read, before coming here, I read Roger Ebert's review.
Oh, you did?
And, yeah, and he really liked it.
He was on board, yeah.
Yeah, he was super on board. We have similar tastes.
Yeah.
with Ebert. But he, in like, kind of, like, the opening couple sentences, he says, this is a movie for people, like, who read Fangoria magazine.
Right.
And then his closing kind of statement is, like, this movie won't be for everyone, but if you read Fangoria and knew what I was talking about, this is for you.
Yeah.
So I think it's just funny that he kind of, like, tapped into that, too.
Yeah. And that is the same attitude that Williamson and Craven have, which is, you know, like, we know what we're doing. You can trust us very quickly, establishing that, and then inviting you along instead of putting up walls. I mean, now, I was trying to think about this earlier today. Could you make Scream work now? And it would just, even Scream 4 has people rushing to the internet to check things, and it's too complicated.
Mm-hmm.
Like, the present day, plus you would have, you know, half the horror nerds in the movie, the characters in the movie, would be arguing over specifics. You know, like you would, yeah, well, that's not right. The Ghostface mask is slightly off. And I know this one was the knockoff that came out later. You know, there's a certain pleasure in knowing that William Shatner's face was the basis for the Michael Myers mask. This lovely little story of just people figuring out a way to make something scarier. They bought a mask, they painted it white, put it on a guy. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
That's it. Scream never has moments where you are stopped dead to think about the origins of the things that are happening. That just, it all happens really quickly in passing. You know, it's, it's a department store costume. You can buy those anywhere. It's great because it just means everyone is a suspect, and any piece of cellophane in the background of a shot could be someone opening a new costume and putting it on in the next movies. And now I think there's so much, you know, trailers are dissected frame by frame and people spend endless hours investing in fan theories, which, I mean, they never work. They don't add anything to the pleasure. This is why I don't. I'm a reverse nerd. I won't watch trailers if I can help it. I don't watch TV spots. I don't want images in my head before I see a movie, because then I'll start trying to figure out where the image goes and why this character is in trouble now, when I've seen another scene before or later in the trailer where presumably that person will live to have that moment. I just, it's too complicated, and film culture is going into a place, especially with genre, like the superhero movie thing, where, oh, who will survive in the next Avengers movie? Well, the movie will tell you if you wait. The next movie will have all that information. Yeah, I know.
That's the thing that, like, drives me crazy, is all the speculation. Like, or even with, like, TV shows. It's like, who cares? Just watch it when it comes out. Yeah. Like, what?
Let the movie...
like, relax.
Yeah. Let the story points come when you're supposed to.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I don't know if you could make a film like... certainly like the first, maybe even the second Scream, work now, because just the announcement of it would start having people pick it apart, and who's cast in this role and what this means. We haven't even gotten to the fact that no one else could play Dewey. David Arquette is a singular performance in all four films.
Yeah.
The fact that he is a credible threat in the first movie and then subsequently kind of the heart of the entire franchise and still just an idiot. He's working on multiple levels in a really entertaining way.
Yeah, I love that part when he's like, I was 24 for a whole year. And you're just like, oh my God. And you really root for their romance. I mean, it helps that they, you know, actually ended up getting together and they have a real chemistry, but totally. Everybody, I think, in this movie was, like, cast so well. Like, I think every single actor is perfect for it. Even like Henry Winkler as the Prince is just like genius.
Yeah. Your heart goes right out to him.
Yeah. And but like I also love Rose McGowan as Tatum. Like she has some of my favorite lines.
And my favorite death, like maybe of all time. Like that, like death in the garage door is just so good. It was just so clever. I mean, it's hard to like find interesting ways to kill people because everything's been done.
Sure.
So when there is an interesting way that someone dies, I live for it.
Yeah.
I live for it. And that always sticks out. Like when people are talking about like favorite movie deaths, like that's always one of mine.
It's a good one.
It's so good. And it just goes up so slowly. Yeah. It's just great.
You were mentioning the Final Destination movies and that, I think that sequence is the closest to it, because the joy of the Final Destination movies in a really weird way is that we can see it coming and you get to watch and you know, the sequels, they would just start to trick you and come up with incredible, like Rube Goldberg murders.
I love those movies the most. Like my mom and I text each other all the time about like Final Destination deaths that we see like in the news. Like there was actually just like a recent like thing that went viral, like a photo of a fossilized skeleton basically, and it was
the
like
Pompeii thing.
Like he like escaped like a volcano and then like a rock fell on his head. Aww. And so I sent that to my mom and we were just like Final Destination. Like even in like the Middle Ages,
that was the first one.
That was the first one.
Pretty cool.
Or there's like I heard,
I just assumed it was a bunch of archaeologists staging something.
Well yeah, sure,
because nothing possible is real anymore, and cynicism is the only proper default. But
there was a few years ago I heard about like this woman who was just like on the beach and it was kind of a windy day, but like nothing crazy, and like a beach umbrella like impaled her and she died. I was like, and I again texted my mom being like, Final Destination. Like she escaped death at some point like that week and it came back for her, you know. And I just Final Destination is a movie that's just like permeated my psyche in a way that I find fun.
Those movies are fun. They're so fun. It's messed up because you're like, well, it's literally about people dying. Like, every time, you know, pretty much everybody's going to die because death is the villain of the movie. And we're rooting for death.
Yeah.
You're rooting for death.
Which we are in all of them anyway, right? The Friday the 13th movies especially. They're just, you don't care about the characters. You're just waiting to see how they get dispatched.
Totally.
And Scream reverses that, too, and makes you want them to survive because even though the requirements of the movie are that you have to, you know, a bunch of teenagers have to die before someone learns a lesson, at least in Scream, those people are interesting. They have lives. And yeah, we root for them. And it's, and again, it establishes that so, just so beautifully in the opening sequence with Barrymore, and then just keeps finding new ways for us to invest in these poor people who are really just there to, you know, have too much gel in their hair and then be killed.
I even like, it's so messed up, but I like even like care about Billy and Stu, like to, like a little bit. Like I'm invested in them too. Like the part when Stu is like, "My mom and dad are gonna be so mad at me." That part always gets me, which is like, it's funny.
Yeah, it's really funny.
And apparently
funny.
He like ad libbed that, and then Russ Payton was like, "That's brilliant. I have to keep that in."
I can see that.
But like, I just, that seems so real to me, and like I'm also like horrified as to what he's done. But I'm like, oh my god, like he's. Yeah, if he gets through this, he's screwed. His mom and dad are going to be really mad at him, you know? Yeah.
It makes him pathetic in a way that none of the other horror villains ever really is, right?
Yeah, which I love.
Yeah.
Because they are pathetic guys. Yeah. It's so sad. Like, the whole conceit is that they're, like, they were basically, like, upset about the affair that was happening. Yeah. And that they decided that they're going to, like, kill her mom.
A bunch of people.
Yeah, like, it's messed up. Anyways, they're all like terrible men. Perfect example of terrible men.
Well, that's the other thing I was trying to figure out is that the movies, I don't know that you could make a Scream movie now in the current climate of, for lack of a better term, wokeness, of a woke Scream movie, because so much of it depends on baiting and switching about who a nice guy is and who he isn't. And I don't think at this point anyone would believe anybody.
Mm-hmm.
They're, which could work for the mystery of it, but at the same time, people would believe Sidney more quickly. There would just be, like, the atmosphere has changed. And also, of course, all of these films were produced by Harvey Weinstein, which is another total weird smear on them.
Yeah.
Not, well, Bob, I suppose, his enabler. The Dimension Films was run by Brother Bob. But, these are actually the movies that I've been using as examples of, you know, when can you watch a movie again with his name on it? It's like, when the Scream movies let you root for.
Yeah, I know. It's something that's, like, I had a bit of trouble with when everything fully came out, that I was like, can I love these movies still? And, I mean, they're just so much in my lifeblood that I, like, I can't really let them go. But, I mean, when I watch a movie and I see that this is, like, literally about the trauma of a woman, I'm just like, I can't believe that these are the movies that they were greenlighting when they were literally doing that, which makes me hate them more. But also, like, should I not, you know, watch a story about a woman overcoming trauma and feel uplifted by it too? Like, I don't know. It's very complicated.
It really is.
Right? I mean,
there's no right answer. There are a lot of wrong ones, but there doesn't seem to be a right answer on this yet. Nobody's... And I struggle with this constantly. I think we all get to decide what we keep from these things, and... It's easier for me, I guess, because Weinstein didn't direct the movies. He simply got them made and commissioned them. It's more of a controlling thing going on. But also, Rose McGowan is in this movie, and Rose McGowan went through some really horrible shit.
That is the worst part for me, I think. But it's really tough. But I love this movie so much, I can't ignore that it exists. I mean, I knew about it before. And I honestly love Wes Craven so much. So that sort of, maybe, I don't want to say trumps it, but like I felt like he was like a real supporter of female characters, and so I love that part of it, and that's what I take away from it. Even Music of the Heart, like I said,
right, exactly.
You know, like he's made quite a few vehicles starring women, and that's excellent to me. And I mean, I guess Kevin Williamson has written some stuff too, but
I you know, we're at a place now where every day there's the possible revelation of something else that you love that has to go away for a while.
Yeah.
And that's, it wears on you a little.
Well, so, there's lots of other things to pick apart in this movie, too, that, like, could make you not want to watch it. Like, you're talking about, like, wokeness, which is something, a word that I, like, hate, but...
I know, I'm choking. There's just nothing else that works right now.
But, like, there's no black people in this movie.
Yeah, they introduced him in the second one.
That's right. And they probably did that because people were like, there's no black people in Scream, you know? And it's like, oh, but they also like die immediately at the start of the movie.
It's a weird unconscious bias of a lot of horror films from the 70s that got carried over, I think, into Williamson's script. Just that, you know, like Halloween is Lily White and Friday the 13th, when it had black characters, they were like Michael T. Williamson in the fifth one where he was just an asshole, you know, studded caricature and all that. And I don't mean to defend it, but it's a trap I can easily see someone falling into because they're just replicating the things that they saw, which is the whole problem.
Yeah.
But it's like, this also was trying to reinvent things. Yeah, like, maybe it could have had an opportunity to do that. But like, you know what? Now that I think about it, like, Get Out might be, like the next generation of a Scream. Because it's a smart movie. Yeah. It's funny. It also has some scares. And it's saying something bigger. Like, I think, like, that's the closest that we've probably gotten.
Now that you mention it. I mean, it also works better if you understand the tropes that it's referencing and the stuff that it's playing with.
Yeah.
And, again, it plays like gangbusters in a theater.
Absolutely. Yeah. And the person that made it, like, loves horror movies. Like, Jordan Peele loves horror movies. And you can feel that, and that's why I enjoyed it, because I was like, he knows what he's talking about. Like, you can tell, you know, Rosemary's Baby is a movie that he loves. Night of the Living Dead is a movie that he loves. And you can see it. I mean, he's less overt with the references, I feel like.
They're baked in a different way.
Right? Yes.
Like, they're in the windows. They're in the design of everything.
Yeah. So, I mean, maybe with Get Out being such a hit, maybe we'll get some more fun stuff like that that's imaginative and is modern. Because that's what that is. That's like a modern take.
Yeah.
I mean, it's hard to reinvent stuff. Like, that's why people don't do it all the time.
Yeah.
You know? Like, Scream reinvented the slasher genre. So, you know, it took, you know, 15 years to get there. Yeah. So
now 20 years later, we can respect it and still see, oh, look, it's another Halloween movie coming. Let's see which direction they take that in.
Yeah. Yeah. So, you know, it's not easy to make things new when everything's been done.
Yeah.
It sucks because, like, as consumers, like, we want new stuff, but it's hard to make. So,
yeah. Well, that does kind of bring me to the closer of the episode, which is that, you know, is there anything from Scream, maybe not in your podcast, but Emily, you've made a short film now. Is there anything that you guys take or have appropriated or used or absorbed into your own creative DNA?
Absolutely. The short film I'm making is a horror film, and it's all girls, and it's set in 1996.
Okay. So. Well,
and I literally rewatched the opening of this to really get a sense, because we were saying, like, that's a perfect little short film. And I think, like, our movie is set inside a house. It's a little horror story that is totally inside a house. And it is more supernatural than this is. But I just wanted to see, like, how you can make something so tight and so scary and that you care for this character even though you've just met her. And so I really looked at that very closely. And even, like, it's so weird, but, like, production design, like, couches, all those type of things. Like, I really looked at Scream because it was, like, the perfect example of that time period for me. And also, this movie just, like, is a perfect balance between fun and scary. And I think, like, that's what I'm about. And that's the kind of thing that I want to make. So, yeah, absolutely. And even, like, I was watching the closing credits, you know, when they, like, do that, like, picture of the person and the text beside it. And I was, like, I texted my partner, Josh, that I'm working on the film with. He's my co-director and writer. And I was like, we should do this. And we've, like, this, like, floating heads. We've been thinking about it for the poster because we're, like, we want to, like, evoke that time period. Like, it's just, it's so in our DNA, like, that particular period of horror movies. So it's absolutely influenced me. And actually, my phone case is Drew Barrymore. Where did it go? Well, I'll show you, but I have Drew Barrymore on my phone case. So, like, it's part of me. I don't think I can remove it from me at all.
Mm-hmm. Nor should you. No. Really, I mean, honestly. And Danita, anything from you?
Well,
is it working to the comedy? Because it is funny. I mean, it's a good
definitely
primer
funny.
On how to subvert expectations. And
yeah, and I think, like, I have a hard time with, like, horror and comedy because usually I'm not into it. Like, because Joss Whedon does it. Like, Cabin in the Woods, I just, like, I on such a visceral level hated that movie.
Okay.
But so this is a movie that really, like, just, like, exemplifies the horror comedy genre for me. But I would say, just like Emily, like, this movie is just, like, a part of me. And, like, what I take out of this movie is, like, a celebration of movies, which I love. And I think, like, when I was watching it, and, you know, I'm quite past my teenage years, but so much about my teenage years, like, was discovering movies, and that's all I did. And I think, like, now that I'm, like, approaching 30, I'm always, like, chasing that high of discovering new things, because you don't get it as much as you get older, because you just, like, naturally, like, see more things.
Sure.
So there's less for you to discover. So kind of, you know, when they're, like, in the hanging out in the house and, like, you know, watching old movies, like, that's what I did, and that's what I still love doing. So I think for me, this movie is just about, like, the celebration of movies, which is, like, what our podcast is about. And I think, like, women in horror is such a, like, rich topic, because movies, you know, the classic horror movies, like, weren't made for us, you know, they weren't made for us in mind. So it's really interesting to go back and kind of, like, pick things out of them to relate to appreciate. So yeah, I think women in horror is definitely, like, a topic we're gonna get into a lot once we get into our podcast more. So
yeah, I can't wait for the Neve Campbell episode.
We definitely, I want to do Drowning Mona, but
oh my god.
Trust me, Norm, it's good. No. It is weird and dark and funny.
I remember the weird part.
It's weird. It's weird.
She loves Bette Midler.
I love Bette Midler, so I kind of went in, I think, like, really optimistic about it. But then I, like, rewatched it, and it's just, like, so dark and weird. So, and that's something I appreciate in a movie. So, anyway. So, but I don't know if Emily will agree to do Drowning Mona.
But the whole thing with our podcast is, like, we want to talk about stuff that we both really enjoy. So,
yeah.
I mean, that is the challenge of it. But so far, like, we're a lot on the same page. And
three episodes in, we're on the same page.
We're on the same page so far. But that we're bringing guests and stuff, too, which they'll bring films that they love, which I think, we're doing a horror episode coming up.
Right.
Probably at the end of the month.
Yeah.
It'll be coming out. And it deals with one of my favorite Final Girls. I've already talked about her today, so that's a hint for you guys.
That's true. Right. Well, that's a great out. We'll deal with that.
Amazing.
My thanks to Danita Steinberg and Emily Gagné, whose brand new podcast, We Really Like Her, is available everywhere you get podcasts. It's a fun show. Subscribe today and get the new episode tomorrow. You can find Danita on Twitter at Danita Steinberg and Emily at Emily Gagné, all one word in both cases. And you can find Scream on Blu-ray from Lionsgate Home Entertainment in the US and E1 Alliance in Canada. It's also available on iTunes and Google Play. As always, you can find me on Twitter at Norm Wilner and elsewhere on the internet at NowToronto.com. You can also find this podcast on Twitter at Semcast, S-E-M-Cast, and on the web at SomeoneElsesMovie.com. If you feel like leaving a review on iTunes or Apple Podcasts or wherever, it would be greatly appreciated. Every little bit helps, it truly does. Thanks for your support, and thanks for listening.